Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba. Hi, Mark DeLuzio here for episode 38, and this is a very special episode. I have my friend and mentor and somebody who was dumb enough to hire me back in 1987 at Jake Brake, Danaher's Jake Brake, Art Byrne, a good friend. Art, how are you doing today?
Fine, thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Yeah, I know you're just coming off a leg surgery, and we hope you're going to be out in the golf. Well, you said you are on the golf course now, hobbling around and hitting the ball.
Yeah, hitting the ball not too well, but you know, I went to the knee store and bought a new knee, and it's taken quite a long time for it to come around. But it's
getting incredible. Yeah, it's an incredible operation. Thank God for that. You know, a lot of people would be in wheelchairs right now if it wasn't for that operation. So far, knock on wood, I'm okay there, but you never know. But Art, we're going to talk about a couple your new book today. First of all, just to let everybody know Art's background, Art was a senior executive at Danaher and was responsible for bringing in, I argue it's the modern lean movement in the United States, okay? Now, I was lucky enough to have gotten hired under George Kornesaker, who worked for Art. George was president of Jake Brake, and I came in as a finance guy. Then I turned into an ugly operations guy before I took over the Danaher business system. But Art, we brought in Shingajitsu back in 87, and we're the first company in the U.S. to bring Shin in. And if you guys don't know who Shingajitsu is, they're the five of the 10 engineers that Tashi Ono handpicked to help him implement the Toyota production system in Toyota after World War II. And so you can argue that we learned it right from the horse's mouth. And there's a million stories that we could tell about our experiences with Shingajitsu, guys like Iwata and Nakao and what have you. And so Art was there. And then when he left Danaher and went over to Wiremold as CEO, it was a private company. And maybe I'll let Art talk a little bit about the metrics there, but he did some unbelievable things. And arguably, Wiremold was perhaps the best lean turnaround in the United States, even in a lot of cases better than Danaher. And so Art led that charge and grew that company. And it was a phenomenal success. And so he wrote a couple books. One of them is called The Lean Turnaround. And you can get that, all these books you can get on Amazon, and I believe they're all on Kindle, Art. Is that correct?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Well, The Lean Turnaround came out, and then right after that, The Lean Turnaround Action Guide came into it. So one of the things you're going to find about Art's books is that they're very hands-on. They're not just theory and principles. It's, oh, yeah, by the way, here's how we did that. Here's the mistakes we made. Here's actually what we encountered when we did this. And that's kind of the tacit knowledge you don't get a lot of. Most of the lean books that are out there today, you don't get that. Okay. So The Lean Turnaround was his first book, The Lean Turnaround Action Guide. And now he has a new book that we're going to talk about today. It's called The Lean Turnaround Answer Book, 40 Years of Lean Observation. Now, this book represents, I believe, Art, the common questions you continue to get asked about a lean turnaround. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Yep. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about that or a little bit about your background in Wiremold and some of your thoughts on that.
Sure. Seeing how you introduced all three books, it's interesting how one book flowed to the other book because originally, you know, I decided to write The Lean Turnaround just to sort of pass on the knowledge that I learned over many, many years implementing lean in a lot of different companies, because like anybody that's learned lean, we all learn from somebody else. Somebody else taught us, like Shingajitsu or visiting other companies and asking them questions and that kind of thing. And so I thought I ought to just pass on my knowledge to try and help other companies actually make the conversion to lean, because I think the conversion rate to lean is still pretty low, and the conversion rate of companies that are successful, even the ones that try it, is even lower. Right. And so I wrote the Lean Turnaround for that. It was sort of a general look at lean and why it applies in any kind of company. And it became a pretty popular book. But I got a lot of questions from that, which was, gee, Art, we really loved your book, but how do you really do this stuff? You know, we want to know how to really do it. So I thought about that. And then that created the Lean Turnaround Action Guide, which is sort of a funny title, but the Lean Turnaround Action Guide won a Shingo Prize. And it's really a case study of a lean turnaround. So we took a company and we had 5 years of financial information in the traditional way. And the company was doing well. It was growing, margins were getting better, everything was getting better, but at a slow rate. But it would be a pretty good looking company for most people looking at it. And then we took people through the changes that needed to be made. And we had that also had a lot of dialogue. So as we went through the changes, we had a management team, and they could ask questions, and the workforce could ask questions. And we tried to ask all the questions that you typically get when you try and do this. You know, all the, well, gee, why can't we can't do that, we can't do this, that'll never work, all that kind of stuff. And then we even had three chapters on Kaizen, three different Kaizen chapters in the book. One was on setup reduction, one was on flow, and one was in the office. And then at the end, we showed the 5-year results under lean and, you know, in a financial way. So, you know, being a case study, it's like something you would do in a business school, really, where you see the financial results before and the forecast, and then you see what happens when you do lean. So that book was very popular, but the two of them together led to a lot more questions about lean, because everybody had a lot of questions. And fortunately for me, the Lean Enterprise Institute, or LEI, was able to give me some space on their, what they call the Lean Post, which right. comes out every week. And so for the past 8 years or so, I've been writing an article under the title of Ask Art to answer the questions I was getting about lean. And it covers, you know, overall, I wound up writing 100 of these articles. And I thought, well, gee, you know, we got a lot of good knowledge here, but they've sort of come out over a period of time, one at a time. And it would be nice to capture them all into one location, into a book that people could use as a reference, because, you know, people that are going to start lean, or people that have started but stalled out, like your book Flatline helped them with,
right.
you know, they wind up with a lot of questions, but guess what? They're all kind of the same questions. And so we selected 70 of these 100 articles that I think answer just about every question that people could have about lean, whether you're starting halfway through, a little bit further through, stalled out, or wherever you happen to be. And we divided it into kind of 5 sections. So there's articles on lean fundamentals. You're not going to do lean unless you really understand the fundamentals. If you don't understand right. tack time and flow and that kind of thing, you're never going to be successful. So we have a lot of articles on that to just help people understand what is this really about, because lean to me it's not some bunch of tools or something like that. It's more of a strategy and a philosophy. How do you think yeah. about something? You know, when you and I, Mark, go and look at something, we see something totally different than a guy who's been running something traditionally his whole life, because right. you know, because we've had the experience, but also we have a philosophy and a way of thinking about things that's different. So first section is on the lean fundamentals. And then there's always a lot of questions on lean management. How do I get my managers to do this? How do I run this, et cetera, et cetera? We have a whole section on just answering questions about lean management. And then we have a section on how do you implement this lean implementation? You know, where we talk about things like, what's the difference between Kaizen learning and traditional problem solving? You know, and if you think about traditional problem solving, the way most companies do it, they form a committee and the committee is almost all made up of salaried people. They have a target that they want to hit. They get together once a week, and over a period of time, they do some analysis and they come up with a strategy. And then that has to be approved by management. So it might take them a couple of months to come up with a strategy. And then it takes another month for management to approve it before anybody's willing to spend any money or move anything or do anything. Whereas, you know, the Kaizen approach is same thing. We form a team, but the team has both salaried and hourly people, the people that are actually doing the work on it. And we set some very aggressive targets, and we want to, and it's a full-time job for a week. It's not, you know, we meet once a week for several months. It's a full-time, all-day-long job for at least a week. Sometimes it can be 2 weeks or whatever.
Sure.
And we set a target, very aggressive targets, and we almost always beat the target. So, you know, whereas the traditional approach is a sort of study approach, the lean approach is a doing approach. We're all involved in it. We're all, the whole Kaizen is all about doing. So by the end of the week, you've got a new cell, you've got a new approach, you've got a new way to do things, et cetera. So they're dramatically different. So we talk about that in the section of lean implementation. And then we have another section about organizational structure, because, you know, in my opinion, one of the reasons that companies have so much waste and so much problems is it's really their organizational structure. You know, if you're structured in a batch where, you know, all the drilling machine, you know, in a functional organization where all the drilling machines are in one department and all the milling machines are in another department, all the punch presses are in another. And I, you know, this is the traditional way of doing it. If you think about it for a second, you say, well, why do people do that? Do they think that the machines will be happier if they're with other machines just like them? Because it certainly doesn't make any sense as a way to make the product. But that's the way everybody organizes. And as soon as you organize that way, you wind up with enormous waste. And it's very difficult to change and get rid of that waste, you know. So there's a lot of articles on the organizational structure. What do you have to do to your structure, you know, to really change and become a lean organization, right? I mean, I look at it from the point of view of, if I see a company, and I'm sure you're the same, that it's turning inventory three times, right? I can tell you right off the bat that, first of all, you have 25 to 40% too many people. You have 5 to 6 times too much inventory. You have at least 50% too much space, which is, of course, where you're storing all this extra inventory. You have long lead times, and you have probably a lot of periodic quality problems that are very hard to solve because you have a 6-week lead time. And when do you know the problem was created if you don't discover it till 6 weeks later, right?
Right.
So
right.
The organizational structure of lean is very, very important. And there's lots of questions about that. And so we provide articles that answer all those questions. And then there's a sort of catch-all section at the end about more thoughts on lean. And here we talk about things like lean accounting. We talk about the walk of shame, which, you know, people don't know what that is, but it's a very effective tool to get people to understand what the waste looks like. I had a great example when I left, after we sold Wormhole and I joined the private equity business. One of my portfolio companies, we were at a plant in Union, Missouri, big factory, making file folders and hanging file folders, that kind of stuff. And we had about 40 people on about 4 different Kaizens. And so about Wednesday, I said to the Shinjitsu guys, hey, let's do a walk of shame so that people start to understand. So we go out on the shop floor, and the consultant, the first thing we come to is a big pile of work in process inventory. And he says to the plant manager, Bob, give me $20. And the plant manager says, what do you mean? He says, just give me $20. So he goes in his wallet and he gives him $20, takes the $20 and he stuffs it up into the, in with the work in process. And he says, look, you're wasting all the company's money. You might as well waste some of your own. And then we move on to the next station. So It was very, everybody laughed and thought it was funny, but I can tell you what, that plant manager told that story for years. He learned so much. He learned so much from that walk of shame. So things like that are in this this section of More Thoughts on Lean. I even have an article about, can you use poetry to do lean, right? Now, everybody would say, poetry, lean, you got to be out of your mind. But this is a great example. We bought a company when I was at Warren Mool, and of course, we had standard work for acquisitions. As soon as we bought it, we went there, and the very first week, we started doing Kaizen, right? We introduced everybody to Lean, and then that afternoon, right away, we started doing Kaizen, and we continued the Kaizens for the week. So during the Kaizen, I wandered around, and this business had a huge area called, they call it the inventory control area. What it was work in process. And this was stored on these enormous racks. They went up about 30 feet, and there must have been about 10 or 12 of them. And so I went out there with a pad of paper and some duct tape, and I wrote a sign that said, parts hotel closing, this rack goes away by, and I put a date, like a month later. And then on every rack, I put parts hotel closing, this rack goes away by, and the date was 1 month later. So on the way back to the office, this lady with a funny hat, she was in a little office out in the factory, and she pokes her head out and says, hey, you. And now she knows who I am, but you know, she just says, hey, you, I need to talk to you. And I says, why? And she says, well, what are you doing to all my racks out here? My people are all upset. You're putting these signs up that they're going to go away. And I said, oh, do you run this area? And she said, yes, yes, I do. My name is Barbara Looney, and I run the area. So I said, oh, great, come with me. I want to show you. And I took her out to the racks, and I showed her the signs. And I said, look, Barbara, I every time a rack comes down, I want you to send me my sign so I know that it came down. And the reason we want to take them down is because we can use all this. This money is just wasting. It's sleeping here, and we need the money. We can invest in new equipment. We can fix the building. We can do a lot of things with it. Right now, it's just waste. So she said, okay. So I'm back there a month later doing another Kaizen, and she comes up to me and she says, Art, come and let me show you. So she takes me out, the whole rack gone, completely gone. And she hands me my sign, just like I asked. I said, Barbara, that's great. And then she hands me a poem. And the poem is about Dame Barbie and her merry men, and how King Arthur had said that these racks had to go away. It was really pretty funny. So I said, that's great. Thank you very much. She says, no. She says, we're not done. I said, what do you mean we're not done? She says, well, I gave you a poem. You got to give me a poem. So I said, okay. So I went in the cafeteria while they were preparing the final presentation for the Kaizens for that week. And I wrote a poem called The Parts Hotel, and how we treat our parts very well, and they go in and they rest and they get rusty and they all these things. And anyway, when we had the final presentations of the week-long Kaizen, I read her poem and I read my poem. Well, this went on every month. Every time I was there, she gave me a poem. I wrote a poem. We read them at the readout. And in the end, we freed up something like, I don't know, 25,000 square feet of space, and and $2.3 million worth of inventory was gone. We used that money for a bunch of other things. So, you know, it sounds a little nutty, but, you know, these are the kind of things that people should be aware of, is how do you get people engaged? How do you get them involved in Kaizen, make it fun?
Sounded like she initially was pushing back, but then somehow through whatever magic, she became very engaged, and sounded like she had a lot of fun doing this too.
Yeah, everybody had a lot of fun with this, but you know what you just said is very important, which is, I've always found, and I'm sure you have too, a lot of times the people that are the biggest initial resistors to this, once they understand it, become your biggest advocates. Right? I'm seeing this, and we had this back in Jake Break. We did a sell one time. We had a Jake Break, by the way, was a, as Mark knows, was a UAW location. And so
it was.
We created a cell, and the operators were all bitching about it. Oh, the machines are too close. We can't do this, blah, 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 blah. And we go back about a week and a half later, and they had moved the machines even closer. They moved them even closer. And their question was, gee, this is great. Why didn't you do this before? So you took a bunch of guys that were complaining about it, bitching, we don't want to do this, and they become the biggest advocates for you. And I've seen this happen over and over and over. And it's really part of how you convert a company from a traditional management to a lean culture. And if you can get a company converted to a lean culture, you won't go backwards, and no one's going to catch no one none of your competitors will ever catch you,
No, that's right. Even,
as
that's right.
long as you're at it.
Even a commodity product, you can differentiate with quality and delivery and lead time. It's amazing. You're not a
Absolutely.
commodity. I don't believe there's a commodity art if you can do that right. And hey, question for you here. So you mentioned, one of the things that I'm having a real hard time with today, anyway, with a lot of people trying to do this is I'm trying to convince CEOs that if you don't make a no layoff policy due to lean improvements, you're not going to go anywhere. Okay. And they're so reluctant to do that. I know at Jakebreak we did that with a UAW shop. I negotiated two of their contracts, went to skill blocks and all that stuff. But we never laid somebody off at Jakebreak because of lean improvements. And we had some down years. And then we're ebb and flowing with the truck market
Right.
and the economy. But we never did that. And we always find ways to redeploy people or put them on Kaizen teams or insource when we were outsourcing.
Right.
All kinds of different strategies, but talk a little bit about this, the importance of that guarantee.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very, very important. And certainly when I went to Wiremall, one of the first things I did was to tell everybody we're not going to lay anybody off as a result of Kaizen. And we never did. And of course, people say, well, wait a minute. You can't do that. Wiremold had a union too. We had the IBEW. And traditional people will say, you can't just give something like that to the union without getting something back. You can't just give that away. And I said, yeah, I can, because w without their buy-in, we're not going to go anywhere. Think
That's
about
right.
what happened. Let's say we did a Kaizen and we went from 10 operators down to six. And we laid the four that we got rid of, we didn't need anymore, we laid them off. And then, but we used a lot of the operators to help us go from 10 to six. And then we laid off somebody's cousin and their sister, and then we go back to them and say, let's do another cut. No, I'm not going to help you do another Kaizen. You laid off my sister, right? Everything stops. And the reality is, as you just pointed out, there's plenty of things you can do to make
Right.
sure that you can deal with this, even if business turns down a little bit, because you can insource a lot of things that you have currently outsourcing now. You can get rid of some of the overtime. You can get rid of temporary help. All kinds of things can
Sure.
happen that allow you to stay with that promise. And so we were able to do that at Wiremall. We were able to do it in some of my private equity companies as well. Because I think it's a very important thing, because what you're trying to do with lean, it's not the thing that really gets to me is, I think 90% of the companies that start down the lean path, they think of it as a cost reduction program.
Right.
And everything else is going to stay in a batch, and they're going to stay the way they were. We're just going to tell operations to cut costs and use this lean stuff to do it. But you can't, you're never going to get anywhere doing that stuff, because you wind up setting one half of the business against the other all the time. And it's just the wrong way to think about it. But that's how most companies think about it. They think about it as
They
a
do. Yeah.
cost reduction program.
Yeah, it's unfortunate they don't look at the drivers of cost being quality, bad processes, long setups. I mean, go down the list, right, of all the things that we do. The lean accounting, you and I know very well.
Yeah.
Purchase price variances by a bunch of stuff. And, what really upsets me, Art, today is in the press anyway, in Wall Street, who I've done a lot of work with over the years and presented to them, they confuse headcount reduction with these self-anointed lean CEOs who come in and lay off 10, 20, 30, 40,000 people,
Yeah.
and then they pat them on the back as some kind of lean guru. And between you and me, any idiot can lay off people, right?
Right.
That's easy to do. Well, it's not easy to do if you have a soul, and if you have a conscience, you're still affecting people, but it's not hard to do. And what is hard to do is the tough stuff, which is rewarding, is improve your business, get that competitive edge that you're talking about, grow, take market share from your competition. You don't have to buy an acquisition, take their share. And right. and before you know it, you're doing three times as much with the same headcount. I mean, and that's exactly what happened at Jake Break. It happened at Wiremold, maybe even more. And it just really, you know, and I look at you mentioned Kaizen, right? And for some reason, I don't know why people are not doing Kaizen art and they're not doing standard work. And I say, hey, look, if you're not doing those two things, those are two of the three things on the bottom of the TPS house, then you're not doing lean. Right. Take all down all your posters, take down all your yellow tape and your Gemba boards, which are misused, and just go home, you know? Yeah. Because if you're not doing standard work and you're not doing, I mean, real standard work, and Kaizen, what are you doing? What exactly are you doing?
But you know, if you think about it, if you start out thinking that it's a cost reduction program, and your historical way of thinking about that is to do things with less people by getting rid of the people, but you know, you're off on the wrong track. And you know, what you really are trying to do is you're trying to train your people, convert your people, so that they can all help you take out the waste, right? So if you think about a traditional company, let's say it has 1,000 employees. Of those 1,000 employees, I would guarantee you this is probably maybe 50 to 80 that get involved in everything that, you know, any decisions or cost reductions or other things like that. They use the same people over and over to do that kind of stuff. So if you're going to run your company that way, and I'm going to teach all 1,000 of my people how to reduce waste and how to get things better, over time, I'm going to eat your lunch. I got 1,000 people helping me reduce things, reduce costs,
and
get ways, and you still got the same 80 to 100 people doing it. You know, and you're not creating a lean culture. You just think, well, gee, if I can go from 10 people to 6, I should get rid of those other 4. And you know, you and I think of it as no. They helped you go from 10 to 6, and you ought to try and think about what are you going to do with the 4 people. And which 4 people should you deal with? You know, I mean, that's a good question, because I always thought of it as, hey, if I'm going to go from 10 to 6 and I have 4 people that I don't need in this particular area right now, which ones should I take out? Well, if I went to you and you were the manager of the area, you'd try and hand me the 4 worst people that you have, you know, and I said, no, I want to take out your 4 best people. I want the 4 best people to come out because I have a chance to give them a promotion. I have a chance to put them in my Kaizen promotion office. And besides, if I take out the 4 best people, A, the other people have to come up. They have to learn more, right? They have to improve their skills to offset the fact that we took the 4 best people out. Also, if someone's out sick, one of these 4 best people that I took out, they can always jump back in for me because they know everything, how to do the work. So, people just have it backwards. You know, it's like, let's take out the worst people. No, take out the best people. And, you know, it's the same thing. If you go back in history, you know, the big 3 automotive companies in the U.S. always had the mantra of never stop the line. And along comes Toyota and they say, always stop the line. And say, well, what's the difference? Well, every time they stop the line, they get a permanent fix to some problem that occurred. So it's creating a learning environment that allows the company to get better and better. And every time you get a permanent fix, the quality gets better, the costs go down, the employees are happier, everything works better. Years ago, when we started working with Shinjujitsu, and they were also helping Porsche in Germany to get better. So they asked me to come over and give a speech one time at Porsche. And so before we did that, we were touring one of the Porsche main factory in Stuttgart. And the guy who was with me says, you know, at Porsche, for the first 60 years, we never made a car without a defect. I said, what? He said, yeah, the first 60 years, we never made a car without a defect. So Shinjujitsu, and in this case, it was Nakao, was teaching them that actually, you can't think that way. You actually can make a car without a defect. The fact that it has 33,000 different parts is irrelevant. You can still make a car without a defect the first time. So once your brain can switch from "I never made a car without a defect" to "I can always make a car without any defects," that's an enormous mental change, isn't it? It's just a big philosophy and mental change in the management that says, you know, I didn't realize this was possible, but now that I know it is, I'll never go back to making cars with defects.
You know, I think it was Nakao, maybe Iwata, I can't remember who. I think it was Iwata in this case. He said to me once, why are Americans enamored with Six Sigma, 3.4 parts per million? Why are you planning on failing 3.4 times out of a million? And it's a mindset. And Nakao actually said to me, why are you guys planning 98% on-time delivery? He says, call those 2% right now and tell them you're going to be late. Is what he said to me, you know, you know, and it's mind boggling. You know, it's funny, you know, the Porsche or the whole Porsche story is incredible. And I remember going to Japan and spending time, as you probably have, at Iwata's guest house. And Nakao picked me up at the airport in the Porsche that the CEO gave him, the last car on the line. He actually sent it to left-hand drive, sent it to right-hand drive, I should say, send it to Japan. It had Nakao inscribed in the seats. And yep, it was a nice red, I forget what model, 1911?
928.
Yeah, you rode in it too. And it's the first time, Art, I saw navigation in my life. First time I saw navigation. He had navigation. It was all in Japanese kanji characters. First time I saw navigation ever was in Nakao's car in Japan. Yeah, in Nagoya. And but anyway, you know, you go back and look at all of this stuff. By the way, I've used your parts hotel line all the time because I remember you took me over to Wire Mold when you first got there and showed me around, and you say, hey, these are parts hotels. I said, I like that. I like that name. I'm going to use that. You know, so I stole it from you. I don't know if I owe you another dinner because of that, but anyway, so Art, what are some of the other questions you get? You know, I mean, you know, what I'm looking at right now is you mentioned Kaizen. I had one company tell me, yeah, we're going to allow our people to do something on Wednesday afternoon between 2 and 4, you know, and people don't want to work long hours anymore. It's a 9-to-5 mentality. Geez, I remember one of the Kaizens we did at Jake Break. I came in, we started at 7 in the morning. I left at 2 in the morning. That next morning, went home, got 3 hours of sleep. I was back at 7 again, okay? And this was continuous, right? We just worked our asses off, but we were on such a high. Okay, we're in such a high in terms of what we were doing. Yeah, sure, on the weekend, we just crashed, right? But we just kept going, and it was so exhilarating and fun. Right. You know, and I don't see that spirit anymore.
Yeah, we had a similar thing when I first went to Wire Mold. You know, I'll give you a couple of examples. One of them was that Wire Mold had a lot of different equipment, one of which was a rolling mill, which is right, a very big machine. It's 150 feet long. It's got coil steel and all this kind of thing, kind of complicated. And I was out in the shop floor. I'd never seen a rolling mill machine before. And I said, well, how long does it take to change that rolling mill over, right? And they said, oh, it's about 14 hours. So I looked at them and I said, no, well, that's no good. We have to get that under 10 minutes. Now, I'm the new CEO. I've never seen a rolling mill before. And I'm out there telling them, you got to go from 14 hours to under 10 minutes. And of course, they all said, how do we get this guy as our CEO? He's an idiot. We just told him it's 14 hours, but you know, it's past 10 years, right? We can't do any better than that. So now if I had just gone back to the office and said, guys, look, get it under 10 minutes. Let me know how you're doing. I'm going to support you. No problem. Nothing would have happened, right? I mean, they already knew it took 14 hours. But we didn't do that. We started the Kaizen and another Kaizen, and the machine was very busy, so we had to get at it at weekends, and we had to do some alterations to it. Nothing really expensive, but we had to make some alterations. So about 18 months later, we could change that machine over in 6 minutes. So now, you know, when people see that, first of all, they say, well, gee, that's interesting. What's his next stupid idea going to be, right? So they you get a little buy-in. But the real thing that you get out of that is that you've challenged people to do something that they think is impossible. And then when they do it, the buy-in you get, the culture change that you get,
right,
is, you know, there's no
right.
way to put a value on that. It's
right.
just
incredible. You can't go backwards either then. Yeah, that's right.
And we had another one early on at Wyrmore where, like you said, we did Kaizen. We ran into the night. We didn't stop at 5 o'clock. You know, we're 8. So one night about 8:30, 9 o'clock, I'm walking around the plant, and this couple of guys came up to me and they said, Art, you know, this cell you want us to make, the rolling mill that's going to go in the cell is too long. It's too big. You know, the only way we can figure out how to put the rolling mill into this cell is we have to cut a hole in the wall. And I said, oh, okay, go ahead. They looked at me like, really? Really? You're going to let us do that? And I said, yeah, why not? I mean, you just, you know, you guys designed the cell and you said you got to cut a hole in the wall. So go ahead. So after that, my finance guy comes up to me and he says, Art, what did you do to Lance? And Lance was the name of one of the guys that had asked me this question. I said, Lance, who's Lance? So he explained. I said, oh, I didn't do anything to Lance. What are you talking about? He says, he's so excited. I said, oh, I just told him he could cut a hole in the wall. But this was a totally different answer than anything they would have ever gotten before, right? I mean, if somebody wanted to cut a hole in the wall, first answer is going to be no. Next answer might be, we'll study it for a couple of months. But the idea of, yeah, go ahead and do it, that's different. And so Lance turned out to be, he was the head of our employee association. He ran the Christmas party. I mean, he was a completely changed guy. And when my finance guy said, what did you do to Lance? I said, why? And he said, well, Lance was one of the biggest troublemakers and problems that we've ever had. Now the guy's walking on air and he's just engaged and doing all kinds of things for us. So it's little things like that, and understanding that, you know, people are your most important asset. It's the only asset you have that can appreciate. Everything else depreciates. So if you don't understand that and you don't approach it that way, I always think that that management has sort of, you know, three obligations to their employees. One, right? One, you got to secure their job, right? You got to secure their job. And the best way to do that is a growing, healthy company makes jobs very secure. The next thing is you have to improve their skill. You got to teach them new things. The idea of one guy running one machine for his whole career, you're not being very nice to that guy if that's what you're going to allow to happen. You know, you got to improve his skill. You got to teach him new things. You got to teach him how to do Kaizen. You got to teach him how to run more machines, et cetera, because that makes him more valuable. I mean, if the company burns down one day and he has to go out in the open market, you've done him a favor. He's a much more valuable guy. So you got to keep his job, give him more skill. And the third thing is you got to give him a piece of the action. He's the one that's going to help you improve the results and improve everything. And so you want to give him a chance to share in the wealth. And at Wyrmore, when I got there, we were very lucky. We had a very good profit sharing plan that the original owner put in 100 years before, really. But it wasn't paying out very much. It was paying out 1%. So I told everybody, look, I want this profit sharing plan to pay out 20%. So we're going to pay you a competitive wage for the area. And through profit sharing, you should be able to get another 20%, right? Of course, at first, it didn't happen right away. And we did get to periods or quarters where profit sharing did pay out 20%. But over time, it sort of settled in around 14 or 15%. And that was generally because we kept buying new companies. And every right. time we bought a new company, it affected the profit sharing in a short term, right? But then for the longer term, and we paid out profit sharing quarterly, we posted it monthly. So people were very engaged in profit sharing, and profit sharing and Kaizen and Lean go hand in hand because you're making all of these improvements. And so profit sharing doesn't cost you anything. You're paying for it with the improvements all the time. And every company that we bought 21 companies, every one that we bought on the very first day, we said, okay, you're now part of our profit sharing plan. that was a big eye opener from everybody that we bought, right? And then that was for the short term. And everybody, by the way, was in the profit sharing plan. I was in it to the lowest paid person in the whole factory. We're all in it, and we're all in it equally. And then the second, we said, but for the longer term, what are we going to do? So for the longer term, we tried to convince everybody to get into the 401k plan, and we would match that, their contribution, with company stock. Now, we were a privately held company, but we did value the stock every year. And so we had a basis for that. And so, you know, every year we would match your contribution with stock. And the nice part of that story is when we sold Wiremold, after about 9.5 years of me being there, the employees through the 401k plan were the biggest shareholder. So they gave us the gains and they got the biggest reward. And I always felt that that was the way things should be.
Yeah.
It worked out perfectly.
You know, you mentioned acquisitions, Art. One of the things that people don't realize is, or maybe they do, but when you say, you know, I took $1 million of inventory, let's say, out of my inventory, the cost of inventory, and these are real numbers. These are not like back of the napkin MBA type project numbers. You, first of all, have a cost of capital for your business, right? Whether it's debt or stock or whatever.
Yep.
So let's just say that's 10, 12%, whatever it might be. You then have all the associated costs with inventory, including personnel, including forklifts, warehouses, racks, pilferage, obsolescence, transportation, buildings, insurance, taxes. It usually goes anywhere from 20 to 25% of the cost of the inventory. So in other words, if you had $1 million, you can pretty much guarantee that you've got $200,000 to $250,000 hitting your bottom line with that inventory. And I tell that to people that, no, that's not really true, Mark. Yeah, it is, because first of all, you're going to have to go out and finance that somewhere, that $1 million, because you don't have it now. It's sitting on your, sitting in your parts hotel, right? Okay. And they don't get the power of cash and what that means to the bottom line and to your ability to grow.
Right.
You know,
well, I call it sleeping money. It's just sleeping. Yeah. Money. It's sitting there waiting for you to pick it up and employ it a better way. So when I first went to Wiremold, we started cutting inventory dramatically very quickly. And I think we freed up something like $13 million worth of inventory.
Huge.
And we used that to buy the first five small companies that we bought. So we converted that inventory to something like $24 million in annual sales, earning like 10%. So before, it was sitting there costing money, like as you just pointed out. And yeah, now we converted it to earning us money. Right. And over time, we found most of the companies we bought were turning inventory three times. And I always thought that was, they were gold mines, because, you know, sure, we knew that after the first year, we could take inventory turns from three to six times. Second year would be at eight times. The third year would be probably at 10 times. And so over time, what we found was that we could pretty much get all of our money back from an acquisition within 3 years, through a combination of inventory reduction, growing the business, and better margins from taking out costs. So if you can get your money back in 3 years, now you've got a business that's contributing to your growth and contributing to your cash flow, so you can buy the next business. And, you know, it's just, you just have to understand that all that's possible, and you have to understand what to do to make it happen. And, you know, we kind of had standard work for an acquisition. So once we bought it, the very first week, we would be there doing Kaizen,
yep,
you know, and we would, you know, we'd start out, we'd bring everybody together. I'll tell you a funny story about a company out in Idaho one time. It was part of a Fortune 500 company. It was only, I don't know, 10 or 12 million in sales. So we brought everybody in the first morning and we said, you know, let's introduce you to Wiremold. We'll give you a Wiremold golf shirt or something and a cup of coffee, and then come back and we're going to have a 3-hour session on lean. And I always ran that session myself. And then we said, okay, we're going to take a lunch break and we're going to put the names up on the board of the first two Kaizens, right? And who's on the team. And don't worry, the rest of you are going to get to be on a team eventually, but we're going to start this afternoon, and this is going to run the rest of the week, right? So I remember the first day we start the Kaizen, and we were working on a line that had a conveyor, it was a conveyor belt assembly line, pretty long, you know, maybe 100 feet long or something, at different stations and all this stuff.
You and, love those, don't you?
Yeah. So by the afternoon, by four o'clock, I had the conveyor belt assembly line disassembled. We got rid of all the you know, the air and the electricity and everything else, and I hooked it up to a forklift truck and I dragged it out in the back parking lot and threw it away, right? And in the meantime, we had figured out how to incorporate a couple of prior operations, shrink the whole thing by about 60-70%, and go from like 10 operators down to about four, and do the same amount of work, right? So we, at dinner that night, the plant manager, he's just amazed at this. He said, holy smokes, you know, we got four other of these conveyor belt assembly lines. And he said, he looks at me and he says, now, does this mean that I don't have to write the 50-page monthly plant report anymore? And I said, well, look, if you want to write the 50-page monthly plant report, go right ahead. But I guarantee you, I'm not going to read it. And I would rather have you spend your time getting rid of the rest of these stupid assembly lines and fixing this place. And that guy turned out to be a very good guy. And we kept him with us, and he wound up with more responsibility and did a very nice job. But, you know, when you start that way, it's very clear to everybody right away what's going to happen, what the philosophy is, and what to expect, right? Whereas most companies buy another company, and then they want to spend 6 to 8 months studying it and analyzing it and making a decision on what to do. This is especially true of really big companies when they buy another really big company, right? And you see them buy a really big company for an outrageous price, and 2 years later, they sell it for 30% of what they paid because it never fit. They didn't understand it. They didn't know what to do with it. They had no strategy once they bought it, what to do. They studied it to death, and then the whole thing. And in the meantime, you know, if I'm not sure what's going to happen, I should start looking for another job. And, you know, if you lose, you know, 10 or 20 of the wrong people, the value of what you bought goes way, way down. And so we always made it clear to people right away, look, this is how things are going to be. If you don't like it here, you can leave. But this is what we're going to do. It's going to be exciting. You're going to have fun. But there's going to be massive changes occurring.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, my experience in that, and I've seen that many times, is that this whole study mentality is just a signal to me that they just don't know what to do.
Right.
They don't know what to do. Right. And, you know, one of the philosophies that we've learned, you and I together, are from our friends at Shingijutsu, Nikao Niwata, for example, is don't let perfect get in the way of better.
Right.
Right. And that's one of our 10 rules of Kaizen. And many times we want to get the most perfect, elegant solution, which, by the way, doesn't exist. Okay. And then wait for that. Meanwhile, we're jerking around with the last 10%, and we found out the first 90% was wrong anyway. Just go out and do it. Just go out and do it, and you'll self-adjust as you go through. And the doors that were closed to you are going to open as you continue to do Kaizen, you know?
Right. You know, well, I remember early on when we were working with the Shinjujitsu and Jake Break, and George Konensaker and I, we were the only two guys with any kind of prior experience with Lean in Danaher at the time. And we wanted to try and fix Jake Break using this. But we both had some background in our careers as being strategic planners and strategic thinkers, that kind of thing. So one day at lunch, we looked at Iwata and we said, Mr. Iwata, we think that Lean is the most incredible strategic tool that we've ever seen. You know, this is the most incredible strategic weapon that we've ever seen. How can Toyota let you guys loose on the rest of the world to teach people this method, right? And Iwata just looks at us and he kind of laughs and he says, well, look, he says, I can tell you about Kaizen. I can tell you about Lean, or Toyota Production System is what it was called then. I can tell you about the Toyota Production System. I can even take you and show you the Toyota Production System. But I bet you can't go home and do it. And that, you know, that insight at the time, it's still true. It's still exactly true.
It is.
People just can't do this on their own. They just can't. You know,
That's
because,
right.
You know, they can sit around. If you take a traditional company and you say, we want to do this, and you can come up with all these great ideas, and everybody's getting excited. Oh, boy, yeah, oh, yeah, we could do this, we should do this. And then one guy in the corner puts his hand up and says, oh, but what about when this happens? And everybody says, oh, yeah, that's right. Now, the fact that that only happens 2% of the time stops everything, right? Why not fix the 98% that you can fix and your great idea?
They try to assume that it's a normal occurrence, right? Exactly. Yeah. That's a yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's interesting because when you and George Conensaker, and I was the CFO at the time, had enough faith in me to send me to Japan on one of the first study missions. It was in April of 1990. It happened to be the month that Takashi Ono passed away. So I never got to meet him. And but anyway, we went over to Nakao and Iwata and all the whole crew. And I remember being at Toyota Art. And I asked that very question. I said, how can you guys allow all your competition like GM, Ford, Chrysler into your factories here in Japan? And the answer was, what they need to know, they cannot see. Right? And that's kind of what you're saying here.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's so much that happens. It's a, you know, the mindset, how they think, the sense of urgency. The whole concept of, hey, when Nakao told us, you were probably there that day in that Kaizen, you're running that machine too fast. And we looked at him like he had four heads, you know, or to your point, we need to make more inventory and we need to do more changeovers. What do you mean we need to do more changeovers? Ollie White and EOQ says we should do less. You know, and it's just a different way of thinking that, you know, sooner or later we started thinking that way. And it's like, you know, we're not going to accept traditional thinking anymore.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we first started I think it might've been the President's Kaizen Danaher. And we took all 13 Danaher presidents at the time, we took them to Japan for a week, et cetera, et cetera. And we were at one factory. And the way I forget who it was, but they told us I asked them, how much inventory do you have? And they said, well, we have, our target is to have one half a day of raw and whip, half a day, right? So the interpreter was there and I said, well, you should understand that all the companies that we brought here, they all have between 70 and 85 days worth of inventory. And the Japanese guys, the management, they all just looked at each other, flabbergasted. They couldn't understand this. This made absolutely no sense to them that anybody would have 75 to 85 days worth of inventory. They just looked at each other and you could hear them. They're going, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, who are these people? What are they thinking? Because the mentality, it's a mentality. It's how you think about it, right?
Exactly. Well, I remember going up to Toyota's forklift plant up in Indiana. I don't know if you've ever been there, Art. But so they do mixed model production on forklifts. And by the way, the only forklifts in that plant are the ones they make because they don't use forklifts, okay, in their production. And I asked the head leader there, head of the operations, say, hey, what are your inventory turns? He said 15. And I'm thinking, geez, 15. That's like, I've done better than that, you know? No, 15 per month. He had 2 days of inventory. Okay, so he's turning inventory 180 times a year. Okay. In a mixed model plant. Okay. And you know, when you go into a plant like that, you can actually see it move, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Where a lot of these plants you go into today at three or four turns, it's just sitting there. Like you said, it's a parts hotel, you know? Yeah. People are sleeping. I mean, the parts are sleeping. So, no, it's incredible. All right. I can't wait to get into this because this book just got put out. Today is May 10th, 2024. This book just got released this week. Is that correct?
It's correct. May 6th on Monday.
May 6th. Okay. So it's on Amazon. It's on Kindle.
Right.
Okay. Amazon.com. So please, you know, take a look at this book because it's probably got more gems in there than any of the other lean books on your shelf today. Maybe with the exception of Flatline. How's that, Art? which you wrote the foreword to. but if you, and by the way, pick up his other books too, because his other books are also gold mines, okay, in terms of insight, experience, mistakes that we've all made, which, you know, that's where you really learn. And again, this is 40 years of lean observation. So you think about the wisdom that's in this book, and I think you're going to find the time is and the money is worthwhile to do that. So I haven't seen the book yet, but I am expecting a signed copy, by the way. And
don't worry about that.
After I buy you dinner again, right? Is that what it is? Are any last thoughts on this before we close it up?
No, I think that this book will be a great help to an awful lot of people because, yep, you know, the whole idea is how do we get more people to start down the lean path? Right. And in order to do that, you've got to overcome all their objections and all the questions that they have about why do I want to do this, right? Because lean at the end of the day is nothing but a series of leaps of faith. You know, you leap, it's like if you're a traditionally run company, to change to lean, it's a leap of faith. Every time you move machines to create a flow line or something like that, the question in the back of your mind is always, well, what if this doesn't happen? What if this doesn't work, right?
Right.
And that's what stops almost everybody. And so this book will help you overcome some of those thoughts about, well, what's going to happen if I do this? And what about that?
Yep.
And, you know, it's a great reference book as you go along, you know, because you can just go to the index and just say, I have a question. I'm having a problem with this right now. I'm having a problem with what kind of incentive should I use for lean, or what, you know, what should the CEO's role be in lean or whatever. There's an article that tells you the answer to that in this book. And so I think, you know, hopefully this will help a lot more companies start down the lean path and be successful at it. That's the whole purpose of it.
Now, you guys might be sitting out there today looking at this and saying, why would a guy like Art Byrne, who's retired and made all his money and he's sitting pretty and all this, well, you're not sitting really pretty. You just had knee surgery. But besides that, why would he do this? Okay. And, you know, I remember the time, and I'll tell the story, that I was sitting at Murasaki in Simsbury, Connecticut. Art, you had a lot of sushi there. I know you have. And Nakao was sitting across from me. And this is back in the 90s. And I looked at him and I said, Nakao-san, because by the way, these guys idolized Tashi Ono. Okay. Well, I never had the chance to meet. Did you ever meet Ono, Art?
No, I didn't. Nakao was going to meet him, but then he died. Yeah.
He died in 1990, in April of 1990, my first trip to Japan. And anyway, so I said to Nakao-san, what kind of person was Ono-san? And he just sat there and didn't answer. And then I noticed a tear was coming down his cheek. Okay.
Yeah.
Then he gets up and leaves. Goes to the men's room, I guess. And I'm sitting, okay, dumb American. What did I ask him? You know? So Shimbo was sitting next to me, who's since, rest in peace, passed away. And through the interpreter, he says, you did nothing wrong to Lucio-san. He was never asked such a direct question about Ono. I go, okay. So anyway, 5 minutes later, Nakao comes back. And he sits down, and I'm shutting my big mouth, you know. And Lucio-san, would you like to know about Ono-san? I go, well, if it's okay, if you don't mind. He went on for about 45, 50 minutes telling me Ono stories, which I wish I recorded, right? I remember some of them. But, and they were phenomenal stories, right? And then he looked at me and he said, and I know he had this agreement with you too, Art. He said, you are a disciple of Ono through us. You must dedicate your life to passing on Ono's word. So if you're asking why Art is doing this, or why do I do what I do, and why do I write books and podcasts like this and having guests like Art on, this is why we do it. Okay. Because I think we're losing it. I think in a lean community right now, there's so many, people out there today that want to be the next Ono, the next Demi, the next Duran. And we're not just going back to the fundamentals and the basics, just the basics. And the basics will get you there. You know, standard work, tack time, adjunct level scheduling, Kaizen, JIT philosophy, the basic fundamental. There's no silver bullet here. As Art said, it's a lot of hard work. But man, is it not worth it? I mean, come on. But we don't need to reinvent this stuff. Just get it in first. I got asked a question, Art. What's next after lean? What's next after lean?
I know.
Are you kidding me? Why don't you ask Toyota? They've been doing it for 80 years. Okay. What's next after lean? You don't even have your standard work combination sheets up yet. And what's next after lean? Right? I don't know.
That's so, pretty common. Unfortunately, pretty common to see people think that way.
Man, oh man. And they don't understand the power of what we're able to see and how invaluable this stuff really is. So Art, I applaud you for trying to get this word out and getting people to understand what's going on here. And, you know, if you want to listen to anybody, listen to Art, and maybe we'll have you back on the show, Art, and we'll pick a chapter and just kind of dive into it deeper. I don't know. I'd be more than happy to have you back if you'd like down the line, and you let me know, and you know, and we'll go from there. Yeah.
We've got one of the really good articles in this book, in my opinion, is how do you create a lean culture? And there's lots involved in it. It's not just some simple thing, but that could take a whole whole podcast to just discuss.
Let's do it. Yeah, let's set it up down the line in the future. Get the book out there first. We'll get a little bit of. You know, I'm going to publicize it on my network and we'll get this book out there. And then, yeah, let's have you back and talk about that, because there's not a lot of people out there right now guessing the right answer, unfortunately.
That's right. It's, you know, it's all, you know, if all you think of it is lean as a cost reduction program, you're not going to get too far.
No. Hey, look, you will get cost reduction, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But if that's your only objective, you're going to fail.
Right. Well, it's you know, it, an interesting example is, you know, when I first went to Wiremol, I knew the one thing we had to do was we had to, you know, convert this to lean, and we had to get so we could level load the factory, et cetera, like that. Mm-hmm. But one of the first questions I asked was, what percentage of our shipments go in the last week of the month? And you can ask this to any manufacturing company. I'm sure you've asked a lot of questions like that, Mark, and once you've met people. And of course, the answer was 50%. I said, wait a minute, 50% ships in the last week of the month.
That's low, by the way, from what I see.
How am I going to level load this factory if 50% goes in the last week of the month? And by the way, if you're staffed up to deal with 50% in the last week of the month, then you're overstaffed for the other 3 weeks of the month by a whole lot, right? So a lot of problems here. So we dug into this a little bit, and it turned out, well, it was our sales terms. Our own sales terms were creating this. So we're forcing, you know, and it might not be the sales terms, but I can almost guarantee you, if you dig into that question, you're going to find 85% of the time that the reason this is occurring because of something you did. And something
it's a sales policy. I've seen it a million times. Yes.
Something you can change and something you can fix pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And stop that, right? And so we did that. We changed our sales terms. We got people to pay us twice a month. That leveled a lot of things out. Yep. But people were still, we sold the distributor. So they were still using an MRP system to order. So when they ordered, they'd order 4 months worth. And we said, well, this is still giving us this really lumpy demand. And so we went out to them and we said, look, you know, we delivered to you, and we had created a delivery system where, you know, if you were a medium-sized distributor of ours, then we'd say, look, we're going to have a truck come by your place every Thursday between 12 and 2 in the afternoon, right? So we go to you and we say, look, Mark, you got 4 months worth of our inventory, and yet we show up here every week. Why do you carry 4 months worth? And they say, well, yeah, we never thought about that. So what do you want us to do? And we say, what we want you to do is just tell us every day what you sold of our stuff. Just tell us what you sold. We'll treat that as an order, and it'll be on next Thursday's truck. And then we want you to get rid of the 4 months worth of inventory, Get it down. So let's take it down to 3 weeks, just for so you have a little safety and you're not too nervous to begin with. And then take some of that money and space that you freed up and add more of our SKUs, and you're going to become the best distributor of our stuff in your area. And sure enough, everybody that did that, A, their sales of our product grew by 10% and their margins went up by 20%.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, our order incoming orders leveled out. And that gave us an ability to be more better quality, lower cost, better customer service, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, if you're getting 50% of your sales going last week of the month, you can do something about that. That's just not something that happened all by itself.
I have the solution. Just go to 52 accounting periods. That
Hey.
means every week is the end of the month and you'll get it all out, you know? I mean, come on. Well, you know, it's funny. You mentioned if people listening to this are selling into distribution, one of the things you got to realize is how do they get paid? They get paid on something called GMROI, gross margin return on investment. And what's their biggest investment? Inventory. Why would not a distributor do business with Warren Mold if they don't have to carry the inventory and still have and grow the business? Okay. And I tell the story about one of our acquisitions at Danaher Art. We had a temperature controller business. We competed against Siemens and Honeywell, all right? Small little company called West in Brighton, England. And they had a 28-day lead time. And I went in there and I said, I think I can get you down to 3 days. And he didn't believe me. The managing director didn't believe me. We got down to 3 days. And the business went from 30,000 units a year to 110,000 because distributors wanted to do business with us.
Right.
And their GMROI was higher. And our inventory, people say, oh, you must have added a lot of inventory. No, our inventory turns went from like 2 to 18 in 1 year. Okay. In 1 year. Okay. And they didn't, and we, again, all right, I want to go back to what you talked about, you know, basic, you know, one piece flow, cellularization, standard work to tack time, just in time philosophy, don't overproduce. Kill absorption accounting so you're not overproducing and all that. And they grew the business from 30,000 to 110,000 units in about 12 months. Okay. I mean, it's the stuff works, right? When you say it's a strategy, it works.
Yeah,
So,
that's not surprising at all. It's
no.
but no one can get their mind around that. They can't understand that, right? They just can't understand how I can cut inventory and grow the business because before I was so dependent upon the inventory. I have to have it to do what I'm doing. And you know, when you get rid of it, the business is going to grow faster because you can respond faster. And you know, every time if I'm competing against you and you have a 6 to 8 week lead time and I have a 2 day lead time, every time you're out of stock, every time there's a problem, I can pick the business up at book price. I don't have to cut the price.
That's right.
You know,
That's right.
you're out there trying to offer volume discounts and giving away
That's right.
money, and I can sell at book price and I can take market share from you all day long. Just
In
because
many
I
cases, too, are we at that particular example I'm telling you about in England, we got price out of it too. They valued our quality and they valued our lead time, and we were able to get price out of a commodity product. You know, I mean, you know, it's just, you know, it's just unbelievable how it's not really understood as well as it needs to be.
think
So,
about it. If you're running a factory in Minnesota in the middle of the winter and it's 20 degrees below zero, and some truck driver backs in and knocks off one of your delivery doors, a big overhead door, and the cold air is coming into everybody, and you got to get this door fixed. And so you call the first two companies and they say, well, I can get you that door for $1,200 in about 4 weeks. And then you call this other company and they say, well, I can get you that door in 2 days for $2,500. What are you going to do? $2,500, get me the door. We're freezing in here. You
yeah,
know.
yeah, yeah. And you know, it's just amazing how that works. Art, this has been great. I can't wait to get into this book. And once I get it and I'm gonna order it, I'll have you personally sign it next time I take you to dinner. And Art always makes me to buy dinner, by the way, just to let you know. And but I'm looking forward to it. And then we'll have you back and we'll talk about that whole, how do you develop a lean culture? I think it's a really good one.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for having me, Mark. And
Art, it's great. Take care of that knee. Okay. Let me know when you get back up to Boston. I'm coming up that way quite a few times. So I'll let you know and we'll hook back up and go from there.
All right. Well, take care and thank you very much.
Okay, and we're going to show the book at the end of this podcast as well, episode as well, so you get a picture of the book. And remember, you can get this at Amazon.com. It has a Kindle version as well. And put your order in. It's going to be a good one. And while you're at it, make sure you order those other two books too. The Lean Turnaround, which was the first book Art did a number of years ago, and The Lean Turnaround Action Guide. I think you need all three of them. So take a look at that, and let's go from there. All right, thanks. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Take care.
Okay, you bet. Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.